Today, the 28th, at 3:48. With us today is Senator Stedman, Senator Stevens, Senator McGuire, Senator Wilikowski, Senator Wagner, and myself, Charlie Huggins. Online, we have Kevin Banks. Sound off if you're there, Kevin.
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Joni Schleemans?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Okay. Jack Hartz?
Here.
Okay. John Iverson?
I'm here, Mr. Chairman.
Okay. Thanks. And the next time when we address you, we just ask you to put yourself, your name, and you put yourself on the record. In the room, we have Tom Williams. Is that accurate, Tommy? You're good. Bernard Heine? I don't know about that last name, Bernard. Michael Hurley, Michael Fraley, Jason Bruni, Don Bullock, Larry Dietrich, and Ethan Plotko. Is that anybody? Okay, got it. I think this is the second time, as I recall, that we've heard this bill. I talked to the sponsor, and he explained we're not moving the bill today. In the intermediate, since our last meeting, talked to Pedro Van Meers very quickly, and we've got a number of letters that have been introduced. But you know, it's an order of magnitude of the potential that this has. I think would allow us or keep us on task in respect that we got to make sure we get it right. So with that, Jason, could you come forward, please? Give us your name and put yourself on record.
For the record, my name is Jason Bruni. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council, and thank you for the opportunity to comment today. RDC is a business association with a very diverse membership. Our members include oil and gas companies, mining companies, municipalities, timber, tourism, all of the native corporations, very diverse membership. And it's on behalf of the members that I provide my testimony in opposition of SB 80. Because of the diversity of our membership, we believe it is bad public policy and potentially precedent-setting for other industries around the state. To echo the comments that Senator McGuire said last week, predictability is very important for our members, and this obviously does not allow predictability. With the passing of the PPT legislation last year, the state effectively tripled the production taxes on the oil industry in Alaska. This likely will result in over $1 billion in additional revenue to the state this fiscal year. In passing this legislation, the producers are now allowed to deduct operating costs from these taxes. In addition, they are also allowed to take a 20% tax credit for capital investments as an incentive for improving North Slope infrastructure. Further, as statute currently reads, lease expenditures may not include costs arising from fraud, willful misconduct, or gross negligence. SB 80 would preclude lease expenditures associated with improper maintenance of property or equipment. What exactly is improper maintenance? SB 80 does not define it. In fact, industry guidelines on maintenance often change, in many instances, because of new information. Oftentimes, this new information is gleaned from miscues. These miscues do not imply that the facilities were not properly maintained. Unfortunately, despite the best of intentions, accidents do happen, even with proper maintenance. I'd like to refer the committee to Commissioner Norman's letter from last week and indicate that RDC echoes the sentiments of AOGCC's concerns. Obviously, the definition of what improper maintenance is very difficult to come upon. Expenses may not include costs arising from gross negligence. Gross negligence implies a careless disregard for the consequences of an action or lack of action. The state already has the protection it needs, and SB 80 is therefore unnecessary. Another large concern SB 80 creates for my members is the potential for the endless litigation that it creates. Even if improper maintenance is defined, our members feel this will just add to the potential for ongoing disputes between the state and the producers. RDC members strive to responsibly develop Alaska's natural resources. As we strive to do this, I request you do not move SB 80 out of committee. give last year's PPT legislation a chance to work before changing it. Thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Okay, quick questions for Jason. Senator Wagner.
Would your membership be in favor then of the state of Alaska allowing and the expenses incurred by not properly maintaining a pipeline of this nature? Would they be willing to say that they were in favor of the state giving up $40 million and perhaps as high as $116 million of the cost of this project?
I think that there is a process in place for determining what is gross negligence, and so I think that that should go through the courts and as Judy Brady indicated last week, allow that to be.
Jason, that wasn't my question.
Could you repeat your question, please?
I ask if your membership in RDC would be in favor of the state allowing these deductions, which might cost the state between $40 and $116 million.
And I'll just reiterate that it needs to be determined whether it was gross negligence or not. And so if it is determined that it is gross negligence, obviously it cannot be written off. But we don't know whether it was, if they were improperly maintained, Senator.
Mr. Chairman, I just state, we aren't talking about gross negligence. We're talking about improper maintenance, and there is a large difference. So, thank you.
Okay, thank you. Other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Wilkowski.
Yeah, thank you. If we were to, instead of, there's been some concern about the term improper maintenance, if we were to change that to say negligently maintained, would that satisfy some of your concerns?
I think that, I mean, the American Petroleum Institute even has a difficult time determining what industry standards are for pipeline and corrosion maintenance. So I think that's just, it's a vague term, and I think that I would likely not support it even with the changing of that verbiage.
So the only thing that you're willing to support is that the current, you're not willing to support any changes, essentially?
I think that the PPT legislation that was passed last year has a foundation in it for preventing items like this from being written off, and that it's that's the way it was intended to do.
Yeah, Senator Wagner.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to point out that we have a letter in our file from British Petroleum that says they are going to write off these expenses against the credits in the PPT bill, and therefore the PPT legislation does not prevent these items from being written off in its current form. And I'd also like to say this is not a tax bill. This is an amendment to a tax bill, and it basically amends that bill to disallow expenses that the state of Alaska doesn't think should fall under the PPT credits in the first place. So it really isn't a tax bill, in my mind.
Through the chair. I think the question is, you know, whether it is improper maintenance or not. I think that the replacement of, I think the question needs to be asked, if what transpired last year didn't happen and they were just replacing the pipes, would those expenses be allowed to be written off? If in another location, pipes that have a history similar to the ones where we had issues are replaced, are those going to be allowed to be written off? What is the definition of when it's appropriate and when it's not? That's where the predictability is very difficult and where the certainty isn't there.
Can you give me an instance when that has happened?
Well, since PPT just came into play less than 6 months ago, no.
Mr. Chairman, I'm talking about, you made reference to other places where that has happened and they've downsized the pipe. That was the inference you said, where they changed the pipe out. Can you
the
give
chair,
an
I was,
instance where that
I was
happened?
Referring to a future potential if that were to happen. My apologies.
It sounds to me like there's going to be a lot of disagreement whenever we try to calculate any kind of expenditures. perhaps the better course is to just to avoid all this litigation is to simply go to the Groves. Or would that be something that you would be more inclined to support?
We have a very diverse membership that have different feelings on that. I would not be able to speak on behalf of RDC on that. My apologies.
Other questions for Jason? Jason, if you would remain in place, what I'd like to do very quickly is, Kevin Banks, you there?
Mr. Chairman, I'm here.
Yeah, please put your name and your affiliation on the record, please.
Yes, my name is Kevin Banks. I'm the acting director of the Division of Oil and Gas.
As I look at your February 15th memo, the last paragraph, it says, it may also be difficult for agencies to define or establish improper maintenance or improperly maintained. Could you talk to us about your memo and what your message was?
A couple of things, Mr. Chairman, that we tried to address in our memo. First of all, was the question of what we could look at in terms of language like standard industry practices, and then improper maintenance. And so, what we had suggested in our memo to the committee and to Senator Wagner was that we would look to practices undertaken by a reasonable and prudent operator under the same or similar circumstances. Furthermore, improper maintenance might be indicated, if you will, by an unanticipated failure. It's not necessarily a failure would be by itself the only evidence you'd want to rely on to indicate improper maintenance. But you've now got an event that's caught your attention. Now, the way I see this bill working is that the Department of Revenue, upon finding some what an auditor may regard as improper costs paid to reverse a situation that's caused by improper maintenance or something like that, would come to the Commissioner of Natural Resources for advice. And in that consultative role, I imagine that the Department of Revenue Commissioner could either has the choice of asking or not, and also has the choice of taking that advice or not. The Department of Natural Resources may be in some position to help in that case, because we will have I hope shortly, a fully staffed Petroleum Systems Integrity Office. And the role that office will have is to develop with industry internal and controls and how would I put it? Quality assurance programs for each of the facilities, for the pipelines and so forth, and that means that the PSIO would review the maintenance and repair programs that the company has implemented, and in a sense certify, if you will, whether or not those programs are meet industry standards as we know them from people like the American Society of Mechanical Engineers and other third parties, certification organizations. You may decide whether or not the internal control and quality assurance program that is implemented by the company based on their own experience and their own familiarity with their equipment is suitable, and it strikes me that kind of, if you will, certification would be evidence of facilities that are properly maintained in that case, because we would have determined that the company is doing what it should as a prudent operator and informed by the kinds of standards that may be implemented as part of their quality assurance program as proper maintenance. And so cost spec to do that, in that sense, I think we would be advising through our commissioner, the Department of Revenue in that instance, that those are costs that would be acceptable. I wonder if that helps, Mr. Chairman.
No, it does. Any questions for Kevin as follow-up? Kevin, let me ask you a couple of notes. Number one, if you made the assumption that Senate Bill 80 was adopted in its present form and your Petroleum Systems Integrity Office matured, what would the cause and effect be as you see your organization operating?
I don't think that there's necessarily a conflict. In its present form, I would submit that words like improper maintenance and would be developed and further defined in regulation by the Department of Revenue, and that those regulations would conform to a certain degree to the same kinds of things that our Systems Integrity Office would be examining. For example, a reliance on third-party certification organizations, or reliance on terms like the prudent operator in performing actions that in similar circumstances. And that basically is the same kind of measures that our quality assurance people would be looking to.
And if you didn't have SB 80, would SB 80 modify what you're doing, or would you do the same thing without it?
We would be doing the same thing, Mr. Chairman, without it. As I see it, the role that we would have in SB 80 is to, based on our experience under our own program, we would have something to offer to the Commissioner of Revenue in terms of advice about whether or not a facility had been properly maintained, or if an event had been caused because of a violation somehow of the prudent operator standard or other kinds of certification programs. For that matter, whether or not the company had failed to meet even its own internal control at some point along the way.
Yeah, you know, I had a note that I wrote to myself, Kevin, that essentially said that standards and measures are determined by case law, and that you didn't want to be a part of making that determination going through a case law testing system.
Mr. Chairman, I don't recall making that statement.
Okay. Any thought about case law as it might affect this?
Mr. Chairman, I can't help you on questions.
Okay. All right. Very good. Let me ask you another sentence in your memo, which, I read it, I think, yesterday, but this is one you sent to Senator Wagner, as I recall. Yeah, sent to Senator Wagner. It says, there are no standards that the Division of Oil and Gas is aware of that would provide a measure from which to make a decision for corrosion and maintenance of facilities and equipment. Could you just tell us what you meant by that?
Mr. Chairman, it's my understanding after discussing it with members of our staff that the standards for corrosion control are either in their infancy or not particularly well developed at this point. It would be our intention as we go forward in developing the PSIO that we would be developing our own measures for corrosion control and maintenance, and turning to, as I call them, third-party certification organizations to the extent that we can, and for that matter, relying on the internal control and recommendations that industry here in Alaska may also be developing for themselves.
Okay, thank you. Joni, you're there, right?
Yes, I am.
Yeah, would you please put yourself on the record?
My name is Joni Slimmons. I'm the acting coordinator for the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office in the Division of Oil and Gas.
Yeah, Joni, in relationship to Senate Bill 80, since you're the person that's running the Systems Integrity Office, would you give us any thoughts you might have in your review of Senate Bill 80?
Yes, through the chair. Similar to what you've heard from Director Banks, my assessment of SB 80 is that one of the primary functions that the PSIO can play, if it is passed, would be to assist the Department of Revenue in making a determination as to whether certain claims should be deducted from taxes. And we would do that, again, as Director Banks indicated, through assistance sharing the quality assurance plans that we have approved for the various unit operators. It is not a perfect science, and certainly there is no single standard that we rely on or that we will rely on in developing those quality assurance plans, but we will do the best with every available standard and guideline, including the internal guidelines established by industry here, to establish a plan that looks forward into the near term, the midterm, and the long term, as far as an operator's unit maintenance plan. Where those plans are carried out, we can say that they're being reasonable and prudent. They're putting it on the table in advance. They're signing up to do it, and that's what we will be inspecting to. Where they ignore those plans and where compliance is an issue, then certainly we could identify that as a case of improper or no maintenance. Is
okay.
That helpful?
No, it is. Any questions for Joni? Okay, if we could go to Mr. Iverson, would you please put yourself and your affiliation?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Iverson. I'm the director of the Tax Division for the Department of Revenue.
Mr. Iverson, I'm looking at your memo that you sent to Senator Wagner on the 28th of February. You have a copy of that with you?
I do.
Okay. Let's go to the last paragraph. You said the department supports Senate Bill 80 with the caveat that the bill not limit the department's discretion to deny deductions or credits under current law. Could you help us out what that means?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. My concern is that the department at this point has a certain amount of discretion under the standards that are currently in existence under the PPT statute. For instance, we can deny costs based on the gross negligence standard. We can deny costs that aren't ordinary necessary business expenses, or we can deny costs that would not be properly billed from an operator to another working interest owner under the context of a negotiated working or a negotiated unit operating agreement. We have the ability at this point to negotiate or to exclude a fair amount of costs that would be attributable to factors under the current law. What I would not want to see is for this law to end up confining us only to a standard of improper maintenance. So in other words, that was why I suggested that in the draft version of this bill, that the standard be changed from relying on industry standards to taking into consideration, so that we have some the ability to look at things other than industry standards on improper maintenance in case those standards either aren't appropriate or simply don't apply.
Okay. Another for clarification from your same memo, which is like paragraph number 4. It says the department concern is not with the intent or necessity of Senate Bill 80, it is with implementing the bill.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, to clarify that, if what I'm getting at there is that if the legislature deems it fit to ensure that costs for improper maintenance be excluded from deductibility or from credit, that the legislature needs to pass language saying so. What I'm saying in that context is that were we to pass a regulation that expressly incorporates the language of SB 80, that language would not find explicit support in the statutory language and thus be subject to legal challenge. If the legislature wants to make this more of a bulletproof solution, I recommend statutory language, or else we will be arguably subject to a greater legal challenge if we pass the regulation to having this language.
Okay, thank you. Any question for John? Okay.
Yeah.
Senator Wilkowski.
Just real quick, for clarity, what you're saying then is if we pass this bill and you evaluate improperly maintained facilities or lines, then the state will be subject to less litigation. Did I hear you correct?
Through the chair, I certainly wouldn't go that far. I don't think that there's going to be a way to actually get us out of litigation and excluding any of these costs, whether it be through gross negligence, through ordinary necessary business expenses, or through improper maintenance.
Let me rephrase that. If we pass this, we'll be avoiding at least one layer of litigation. Is that fair to say?
Yes. I think that may be more what I was getting at. I'm sorry if I was being unclear. What I'm trying to say here is that I think if we pass a reg that explicitly has this language, incorporates this language in SB 80, that regulation itself is going to be more easily challenged than would such a regulation if that regulation found explicit support in the statute.
Any other questions for John? Okay, thank you, John. If you would remain on, we appreciate it very much. Let's go to John Norman, please.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, I'm on. John Norman.
Yeah, thank you, John. Would you give us your affiliation?
I am the chair of the Alaska Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. We are officed at 333 West 7th Avenue, Anchorage, Alaska.
Right. I'm looking at your February the 16th memorandum you sent to Senator Wagner. Would you give us the essence of what you were getting at in your memo?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. What we were getting at in that letter is to point out, at that time, I believe the bill has been revised slightly, but nevertheless, we were trying to point out that there is no precise definition that would tie improper maintenance to standard practices. There are some ways we could get at it, but it is not quite as neat as just simply saying that the practices employed complied with standards. There is no readily available manual on the shelf. Now, there are various sources, and if we are given this task, then what we would probably definitely do, I think, is follow the lead of the other two agencies, but probably promulgate some regulations to give some specificity to this. I was also on the second page pointing out again with the clear understanding that we are going to do our very best to carry out whatever assignment you give to us. Already in the bill, subsection 6 addresses a disallowance of costs that might result from willful misconduct or gross negligence. So those are the easy, obvious things that are going to leap out at you. And then what we're down to now, presumably, since subsection 19, to have any meaning has to mean and intend something different than is already embodied in subsection 6. So I was attempting to point out there that at this point, we are now going to be looking at toward what I would call perhaps ordinary negligence, or said differently in non-lawyer terms, a mistake. Someone made a mistake. And that is what I was trying to point out in my letter, is that there are mistakes, that engineering is not always a perfect science. And my letter was designed to try to give some balance to it as we all go forward and embark on this.
Thank you. Would you, on the second page of your memo, first paragraph says, finally, one can never lose sight of the fact that significant technological advances have occurred as a result of innovations which at the time were departures from standard industry practices. What's that mean?
Well, it means that, and there are numerous examples from that. I mean, I could give you one of the most obvious examples that's known in the world, and that is Sir Alexander Fleming experimenting in his laboratory, let the lab get filthy, but in the course of it, he noticed that in the Petri dish, certain bacteria were being killed, began to wonder what's causing this. Fast forward years later, Sir Alexander Fleming was led into a spotlessly clean stainless steel lab that was in accordance with the prevailing standards at that time. And his remark was, had I done my research in a lab like this, he complimented him on what a beautiful operation it was, but I would have never discovered penicillin. So that perhaps is an imperfect analogy because it doesn't tie directly into the industry. But I don't have all of the complete facts on the thing that's brought this before this committee, and I want to reserve judgment because should this bill be passed, then we will be asked to consider those in a fresh light and make a determination on them. But the testimony that I have heard from the operator was they felt that they had, by virtue of the additives that they were putting in, had the corrosion situation under control. Now, and were they able to do it that way, then perhaps they would have then set a standard. As it turns out, that failed. And it apparently, or I'll stop there because I don't want to characterize it, whether that was gross negligence, whether that was willful. I just don't know in that example. But I could come up with other examples, if you like, where people have tried new things, they've experimented, some of them have worked and some of them haven't. And what I was attempting to point out here is that you don't want to tighten things down so much that people are fearful of trying anything that is not written down in an API standard somewhere, because that's the way innovation allows technology to grow.
Okay, thank you, John. In the second paragraph on the second page, same memo, you essentially say, we understand and agree with the intent of this legislation, but the last sentence you say, we do, however, wish to point out some of the practical difficulties that may arise in determining whether maintenance has been proper or improper.
Yeah.
Help me out on what you're pointing out that you may not have said thus far.
Yes, sir. I will do my best to do so. At that time, I was thinking through and trying to put my mind forward to the point where this bill may have passed, and we, at some point in the future, are called upon by the Commissioner of Revenue to assist and render advice on maintenance. And I was trying to think, how would we approach that? What standards would we apply? And there are not any often are not any totally uniformly accepted industry standards that we could use as a guideline. What I was also thinking through to myself that isn't fully fleshed out there, but I think you probably perceive there, is that what I would envision is that if there was a dispute between the Department of Revenue and the taxpayer, that could well result in a hearing. And so this would call for what I will refer to as front-loading our efforts, because often in an administrative proceeding, you come in, put your evidence into the record, then an administrative law judge will make a decision on it, and presumably we'd have to fire our best shot up in the front if we felt that the operator had employed less than standard practices of the industry, and consequently we would not be able to say we will have the opportunity to later address this at the trial, because there will be no trial. Normally these will be appeals on the record, they won't be a trial de novo, and so we're going to have to load up, so to speak, and leave no stone unturned in our efforts to support the Department of Revenue if they call upon us for advice. Mm-hmm. And in looking at this, I think last time I used the term that this is, we're now down beyond the real easy calls, because I think they will jump out, they'll be filtered out by subsection 6, gross negligence. So we're now down to the calls about a mistake may have been made here. Was there a mistake? Yes, there was a mistake made. And now we have to point it out. And then presumably, if the taxpayer disputes it, they will come forward with their expert and say no, based upon what was known then. There's also the date stamping of the decisions and the state of the art at the time. There are a number of practical difficulties. But putting all that aside, we would promulgate regulations if this were passed, taking a lead from the other agencies, and then we would try to lay a good foundation for decision making, so that it would not be arbitrary and capricious decision making. And to do that, we would probably start out and look at the American Petroleum Institute standards and their specifications and recommended guidelines, and then behind that there are other well-known professional societies, the National Association of Corrosion Engineers, there's the American Institute of Mechanical Engineers, there are international standards organizations. We would do as much of that as we could. But to finish out, I was asked the question last time, I believe, Mr. Chairman, by Senator McGuire. It was a very good question about would you be able to promulgate regulations that would give predictability and assurances to new investors coming into Alaska and would tell them this is the standard of conduct. And I believe my answer was that no, we will never be able to give 100% assurance of that, because it's evolving technology, and it's virtually impossible to anticipate every single failure that's going to occur and then be able to go back and to be able to promulgate regulations that would address that. It often is a learning process. So my intention in writing this was to indicate we're ready, we're willing, we're able to work on this. We do understand the intention of it, but it is not a simple assignment.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Norman. Stand by. Senator McGuire has a question.
Thank you so much, John. And just a brief follow-up on that, I appreciate your looking into that and responding. And I was going to ask the first question you answered, which is it seems like there must be organizations out there that are a conglomeration of all of the different producers, both big and small, that would have some type of industry standards, and you referred to them. So I do think that's a good place to start. The second thing that I would say is, and I was trying to think of an analogy, but in law you have evidence, rules of evidence, and they're contained in a book and they're revised. But they set out at least the basis for which evidence can be offered and accepted in a courtroom, and it allows predictability on the part of both the defense and the prosecution. And I remember a period of time when DNA evidence was a new concept, and believe it or not, it was very controversial, and often judges would disagree about whether it would be allowed in or not because it was new science. And so there's a place to kind of think about the analogy. I think no matter what industry you're in, you're always going to deal with new technology. At least I hope we're always dealing with new technology and forward thinking. But it seems to me like we really haven't done our job if we don't put together something that looks like a set of rules, a set of guidelines by which our industries can conduct themselves. Because otherwise, what ends up happening is, and I don't mean this with disrespect, but the lawyers win. It's just litigation, litigation, litigation. And it's very difficult to make business decisions. As it is, a lot of these companies, as you well know, are dealing in different nations. They're dealing in some countries that are dictatorships, some that are democracies, and it's difficult enough that way. In a democracy, we should at least be able to come up with some level of predictability. And I think that, again, I will restate my preference, and I think this meeting illustrates why a gross tax at a lower rate would have been the better way to go. It's for this reason. The problem is that when you try to create deductions, the idea is to incentivize, and that's what I want to do, and I love that idea. But I think the better way to do it is through individual legislation, because when you start trying to think about what the deductions are going to be, you're going to end up wrapped around the axle all the time. That's just a little soliloquy, but in the meantime, your job, and this is why you do get paid the big bucks, and as a lawyer, I think, is to promulgate a series of regulations based on what you can do, the best you can do, based on the American Petroleum Institute, what other states have done, other democratic nations have done, and leave a provision in there for innovation. Innovation, to me, is different than complete lack of maintenance. If you're trying at something, using a different type of parasite, and it fails, that is dramatically different to me than sitting back and saying we just won't maintain at all. And I'm not implying here today, and I've made this very clear, I'm not implying that anyone ever did that. But to the extent that there is a simple lack of maintenance, that is very distinct from maintaining in a way and using best efforts based on innovation and technology that you think is moving forward.
Is that a question or just a statement?
I kind of would like to hear his response back.
He doesn't. Hey, John, you got the ball.
Yes. Senator McGuire, through the chair, thank you for the question, and I do understand the point that you're making, and I think that I'm very much understanding of what you're saying. And so what we would do is, if this were to pass, we would promulgate regulations. We would look to the standards that exist that are prevailing standards generally accepted, and that would be the lodestar that we would home in on. As you observed, I think you really put your finger on a key point here, because under a gross tax, we're where we are now, so I appreciate that, but I do want to point out the distinction. You know, the old saying, you take the good with the bad, and under a gross tax, you get your slice of the gross, whatever happens. If you were in a profit situation, Let me give an example. Let's say I have a mall, and in that mall I have a theater, and I'm the landlord, and I have a profits lease where I tell the owner of the theater, that I will, in lieu of just a fixed rent, I will take a percentage of your profits each year. And let's say that the theater owner hires a kid to run the popcorn machine and the kid puts in the wrong additives and it overheats and burns and starts a fire, etc. And now, ordinarily, you'd look back through that, and of course, if there's insurance, why, that's fine, but ordinarily, there are a number of things that might come into play there. One of them would be the Federal Internal Revenue Code, and the owner of the theater would be allowed to claim a deduction for that, barring something that was intentional or grossly negligent, and I think an experienced employee would not fall within that category. Same thing for state corporate income tax. Perhaps you might have partners, and under the partnership agreement, as I mentioned last time, most partnership agreements do not say that the operating partner is liable for ordinary negligence or making a mistake, as opposed to gross negligence or willful misconduct. So gross negligence and willful misconduct are already covered under here, so presumably I'm thinking in terms of ordinary negligence is the term that I would use. Because if it's something that goes beyond that, then it gets already filtered and caught up in subsection 6 and never filters down to section 19. But somebody's going to make a decision and say, well, this is probably not willful or gross negligence, but still something went wrong here. And that's where I envision a question being kicked over to us, and then we would look at it, and then we would look to the standards and have to apply them. We can pull in a lot of these codes, but the point I was trying to make is as you pull in these codes, you may make operators, you may constrain their latitude to experiment, and that may, you know, that may or may not be good, but they may think that if we guess wrong, then, and we don't follow strictly the API standard, and these are normally recommended practices, that there may be a problem here. Once we get done with defining as many potential problems and the codes, and then continually updating those as those codes are done, we're still going to be left with a residue of situations that are simply not defined, that are new situations of first impression, and that's where the cases fall back upon the terms generally, as I've mentioned, willful misconduct, gross negligence, or if it's not that, then you look and say, what would a prudent operator do under the same or similar circumstances? And another standard that's applied is, was the conduct of operations performed in a, quote, good and workmanlike manner? I'll give you a case site that's interesting because it has side by side. The federal court was asked to construe a case where there were two side by side agreements, and in the one, the operator had the common clause that said that we will not have any liability to our partners except for gross negligence or willful misconduct. And at the same time, the partners were suing them for nothing. That operator for not behaving as a prudent operator, and the court was able to work through those and reconcile them, and there is some brief discussion with citations to scholarly articles in the Rocky Mountain Mineral Law Institute volumes and law review articles concerning the application of these terms. But I think at the end of the day, eventually, after, if we don't find neat standards, we're going to wind up asking ourselves, was this what a prudent operator would have done under same or similar circumstances? was it done in a good and workmanlike manner?
Yep.
The site on the case before me, this particular case is a Utah case, 1990, and the case is Archer v. Grunberg, spelled G-R-Y-N-B-E-R-G, and that citation for that particular reference is 738 F Supplement 449. Now that isn't going to answer the questions that we are all grappling with here, other than to illustrate that despite everything, these things get kicked into the courts, and the courts have to fall back on and say, what would a prudent operator do?
Right.
And then they work through an analysis and say, well, they would have operated in a good and workmanlike manner. Or another phrase often used that we sometimes fall back on here is in accordance with good oil field engineering practices. And that would probably be our starting point, since that's a question that's where we begin our analysis if we have to find an operator guilty of waste. We say, was this an accident, an act of God? Or we say, did this come about because the operator failed to employ good oil field engineering practices? But those are a collection of terms, and we would pull those together in the regulations that we would adopt to try to accomplish, Mr. Chairman, the goal that Senator McGuire set here, which is to try to give as much predictability to new players coming into Alaska, because we're viewing this as a law of general application that will apply throughout the state, and we're not necessarily looking in the rearview mirror. I'm thinking ahead 5 or 10 years.
Me too.
Things that haven't gone wrong yet. A gasket may blow on a compressor. I mean, all sorts of examples I could give you where these questions will arise.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Norman. Just as a counterbalance note, when we voted on PPT, we voted on a net tax. And as I recall, PPT had multiple pages of exclusions, just to give ourselves credit, to include the IRS. Is that accurate, John?
I am not thoroughly familiar with the PPT.
Well, that's fine, if you're not. But just using the connotation, as I recall, the ELF was on the gross. And in the end, people said ELF is broken, it's worthless. So just because it has the title one way or the other, and I don't want to get in the debate one versus the other, it doesn't make one successful and one unsuccessful. I mean, quite frankly, I think you can make the case that people like you and people in the tax division writing regulations and implementing instructions, we have a lot riding on their capability to do that and to expand upon and clarification in those exclusions we put in PPT. I'm not here to defend PPT. If we could have BP move forward, please. Thank you, John.
I'm just simple.
Yeah.
That's all.
No, you're not.
I just have a simple mind. I just like a column where I can see. Until I get my CPA.
Mr. Chairman, could I add one final point?
Yeah, in 45 seconds.
Yes. I did want to also support the comment made by Joni Slemons that we're cognizant of the activation of the Petroleum Systems Integrity Office Coordinator, and there are an awful lot of assigned duties, if this goes forward as we understand it may, that would be extremely useful if there was a way to bring that particular office to bear here. That would avoid us having to staff up on some of these disciplines that we don't currently have under our roof. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Norman. And with BP representatives, introduce yourself and put yourself on the record.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bernard Heine, and I am the manager of production tax and royalty for BP Exploration Alaska. I would like to start by thanking the committee for this opportunity to testify on this important legislation, Senate Bill 80. I am joined today by Tom Williams, our senior counsel for tax and royalty in Alaska. For the benefit of the members, who may not know him, Mr. Williams worked for the state in the critical years before, during, and after the construction of the oil pipeline and the start of oil production on the North Slope. He was Director of Petroleum Revenue, responsible for administering the state's oil and gas taxes from 1975 to 1979, and was Commissioner of Revenue under Governor Hammond from 79 to 82. He is known as the father of ELF by many and personally wrote nearly all of Alaska's oil and gas tax regulations and many of the key statutory provisions of the state's tax laws. He has worked in private practice and general counsel for Cook Inlet Region Incorporated before joining BP. Mr. Williams has a unique combination of perspectives.
Bernard, if I might.
Yes.
We can give us a piece of paper on his qualifications. Let's hear what you got to say about the bill.
Very good, sir. Before turning the presentation over to him, I would like to clarify our testimony today, focus on the specific provisions of Senate Bill 80 and their impact on the new petroleum production tax. We offer our perspective as people within BP charged with complying with PPT. For the avoidance of doubt, we are tax professionals and are not expert in oil transit lines, corrosion, or pipeline operations of pigging, and it would be inappropriate for us to address those issues at this time. We are, of course, very happy to talk about Senate Bill 80 and its implications for BP as one of the Alaska's largest taxpayers. 2 weeks ago, Senior BP Technical and Operations Management Tony Brock and Mike Utzler updated this committee on our efforts to address these issues at Prudhoe Bay that we discovered last year. I can confirm that Tony and Mike are available in the future should this committee require further updates on technical and operations issues relating to Prudhoe Bay. And now I'll turn this presentation over to Tom Williams.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Tom Williams, and I am Senior Tax and Royalty Counsel for BP in Alaska. And I join Bernard in thanking you for this opportunity to testify.
If I might, Tom, excuse me. Senator Wagner had a question.
Well, it was just a statement, not a question. This bill is about improper maintenance on a oil line, not about taxes. I mean, the more important thing to this committee is to hear from people from BP, I would think, about the maintenance and the maintenance that went on this line and how that was handled.
Their lawyers aren't going to let them do that. Their lawyers aren't going to let them.
Proceed, please.
Well, I understand that, but...
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. There's only two slides to the presentation today, which are printed out in the front and back of a one-page handout. I hope it's been distributed to you. I'd ask you first to look at the first page of the first slide of the handout, which is entitled BP Presentation to the Senate Resources Committee. The PPT is working for the state of Alaska, and I mean working in three senses of the term. First, it's working in the sense that the PPT regulations by the Department of Revenue clarify in several crucial ways how the pieces of the PPT fit together. Taxpayers know what is expected of them when they compute and make their monthly estimated payments, installment payments, and in making the annual true-up on March 31st of the following year. This is a very complicated tax, and that was a lot of work to put the pieces together. Second, the PPT is working in the sense of providing a major increase in state production tax revenue. For BP, its production tax nearly tripled from about $180 million for the last 9 months of last year to over $500 million for those months. This is fully in line with the legislature's expectations about the PPT's revenue effects. Third, PPT has promised to work in response to the question on my slide that asks, will Alaska attract sufficient investment to stem production decline? The bulk of the known and likely opportunities in Alaska for investing in production are concentrated in the existing fields. That is, investing to slow their decline, to increase the ultimate recovery from them, and to discover ways to develop and produce the 20 plus billion barrels of heavy and viscous oil that are known to exist. The PPT is significantly better suited for this future than the ELF ever was. In addition, through its credit for capital expenditures, PPT provides an investment incentive that was absent from the old ELF-based Act. But even though the PPT structurally has promised in attracting the new investment that will be needed to deal with the threat of declining production, BP believes PPT is suboptimal for the state because the tax rate is too high. If you look at the graph on the second side of the page, you see that if you turn it the right way, not upside down, you'll see Alaska's at the wrong end of the spectrum relative to other major jurisdictions where there's oil and gas. Investments in Alaska have to compete successfully against opportunities elsewhere. And by lowering the PPT rate, Alaska would increase the competitiveness of its investment opportunities. The resulting increase in production will, we are convinced, increase the total revenues from Alaska's property and income taxes and royalties by more than any reduction in the PPT. I'd ask you to go back to the first page of the handout again. Senate Bill 80 and the CS for it would introduce unnecessary uncertainty. We agree with the AOGA testimony given by Judy Brady last week about the overlap between existing terms in the PPT and the new standard of improper maintenance under the bill. I will not repeat that testimony now. But the issue of improper maintenance only governs when the provisions of Senate Bill 80 would be triggered. What I'd like to focus on now is what happens under Senate Bill 80 after the trigger is pulled. In other words, imagine a hypothetical future situation that, by definition, arises from improper maintenance. Mm-hmm. Now, if you look at page 3 of the CS, beginning on line 34, you'll see three subparagraphs.
Hold on, let us get to that. Okay.
Which line did you?
Starting in line 24.
On which page, sorry?
Page 3.
Got it.
It's the part in the bullet point.
Okay, so page 3 of the CS, line what?
Beginning at line 24 is what I'm referring to here.
Okay.
Bullfont begins on line 19. If you look beginning at line 24, you'll see three subparagraphs in paragraph 19 that are designated A, B, and C. Okay. It's these subparagraphs that specify what happens once the improper maintenance trigger is pulled. For the moment, I'd like to skip over subparagraph A in order to talk about B and C, because they raise similar questions about sound tax policy. Then I'll come back to 19A, which presents an entirely different kind of issue. Subparagraph 19B disallows any cost determined by the Commissioner of Revenue to have been, quote, incurred to maintain the operational capability of facilities or equipment shut down because of the lack of or improper maintenance of property or equipment, excuse me, unquote. The first thing to note is that the disallowance is not limited to standby costs for keeping up the operational capability of improperly maintained property or equipment. Let me say that one again, because that was kind of an awkward sentence. The stuff that wasn't properly maintained is not just the subject here. What is disallowed is the cost of maintaining shut down facilities or equipment, but the trigger is the improper maintenance of property or equipment. Not the same term. To the extent they use equipment, they could overlap, but the different language means clearly that they are not congruent.
Give us some examples so we all are seeing the same thing, Tom.
Yeah. Let's say there's an O-ring that was improperly maintained and it bursts a leak, and in order to be safe, you have to shut down a whole processing center, a gathering center. It was the O-ring that's improperly maintained. This would disallow the costs of shutdown facilities, so it would be the whole gathering center. And that's the point, is 19B would permit disallowance of all costs of standing by and staying ready to resume production, even the portion for facilities and equipment that were properly maintained. I don't think that's what you meant. Certainly, from my point of view, it doesn't make sense. It penalizes spending money.
Well, let's stop right there. I don't know. I mean, whether it was Senator Wagner's intent or not.
No, and I don't think that's what it says, but let him go on.
Yeah, okay. Go ahead.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I won't argue with the Senator.
Yeah, no, I understand. I'm just, you know, I mean, go ahead.
And if I may, through the Chairman, I'd just like to say that these comments are intended to help.
Oh, no, this is a bit being constructive. We understand that. We ask you to come here and tell your organizational perspective.
Thank you. Thank you. Mm-hmm. All I can say is, you know, it says you can't get a deduction if you spend money to maintain operational capability. If it were up to me as a former revenue commissioner, I would want a field to get back up and running as soon as possible after a shutdown. But this doesn't seem to do that. Subparagraph 19C now similarly disallows costs determined by the Commissioner of Revenue to be, again, I'll quote, incremental operating expenses incurred as a result of operating facilities or equipment at diminished capacity when that diminished capacity is caused by the lack of or improper maintenance of property or equipment. Here again, the disallowance is not limited to this diminished capacity of the property or equipment that was improperly maintained, but includes diminished capacity of any operating facilities and equipment. Again, does this make sense from a tax policy point of view? I don't think so. 19C is effectively saying that if it costs more to run a field at diminished capacity, the state will deter a producer from doing so by disallowing these costs. I should think that having a part of the field in production, even at higher than normal operating costs, is better than having it completely shut down, especially in light of state royalties and income taxes, which are both enhanced by keeping the field in production. If anything, 19C should be reducing the PPT as an incentive for keeping as much of the field in production as possible, but it does precisely the opposite instead. Thus, I submit neither 19B nor 19C is sound tax policy for the state, and both of them should be taken out of the bill. This gets me back to paragraph 19A on page 3, lines 24 and 25. Under this subparagraph, any cost determined by the Commissioner of Revenue to be, quote, related to the repair or replacement, unquote, of the improperly maintained property or equipment are disallowed. The problem with this new disallowance, from my point of view, is that it double dips on the flat rate, 30 cents a barrel disallowance under paragraph 18. Last week, Judy Brady explained how this 30-cent disallowance proposed by Pedro Van Meers was directed at exactly the same issue that 19A addresses, and how the Senate Special Committee on Natural Gas Development then rejected a proposal like 19A twice in favor of the Van Meers flat rate disallowance in paragraph 18. I'll not repeat those details now. Even paragraph 18 went too far, in BP's opinion, and was ill-advised. Other provisions in the PPT law already address and deal with the questions about adequate maintenance, and they do so in a fair and reasonable way. If the objective is to make the PPT a better law for the future, then Senate Bill 80 should repeal paragraph 18. Instead, the CS proposes to compound the error, not only by keeping paragraph 18, but by adding paragraph 19A to double dip on the same costs. This concludes, Mr. Chairman, our testimony and on Senate Bill 80 and the committee substitute, and I thank you again for this opportunity to appear before you.
Questions for BP? Senator Wilikowski.
Yeah, thank you. I'm looking at your chart here. How much more would Alaska be making if we charged at $50 a barrel, if we charged the world average for our oil?
Through the chair, Senator Wilikowski, I don't know what the world average is.
Is the world average higher than what we're charging?
I don't know.
You have comparisons to other states like Texas, Oklahoma. In those states, are there other fees that and royalties that are charged by private landowners or that are paid to private landowners?
Those are included.
Those are included?
In these figures, yes, sir. Through the chair.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions? I'm sorry, Senator Stedman.
Just add one thing for clarity. That you have Gulf of Mexico on there?
Yes, that's correct.
Outside of state waters. We went through this quite a bit, I think, last year, dealing with the PPT relative to the North America and its tax structure, tax and royalty structure, and where the tax rate of Alaska is relative to that. And, this looks very similar, if not the same data, that was brought forward last summer and spring. But clearly there's other data, other basins, and we also looked at all that. So,
through the chair, that's correct.
Okay. I'm sorry, Senator McGuire.
I have a
Mr. Chairman, I don't know if you can answer this, but with your vast background in tax and being one of the fathers of ELF, I understood the chairman's points, and I agree that there's no question that the ELF was somewhat of a hybrid. That said, I imagine you've studied tax systems all over the world that BP and other companies have entered into agreements on or been subject to as a result of them existing by dictatorship or on the statutes in democracies. And I guess my question is, I made a statement earlier about the ease of simply taxing the gross amount and figuring out what deductions you'd like to give in a more controlled legislative way to offer incentives. And I guess you probably can't answer this honestly, but this is my concern. I mean, I want these companies to maintain their facilities. I want them to be encouraged to maintain and to operate. I see good lawyering going on in arguing on B and C, and I see where you could make those arguments, and I think they could be compelling in a courtroom. And because I think they could be compelling in a courtroom, I'm concerned, because I think the overall goal is to have safe, good, well-maintained operations in Alaska. So if you were king for the day, what type of a tax system works the best? And we know we've never seen anything like this. I mean, that testimony is on the record, and Pedro and others have said they've never seen anything like this PPT. Can you answer it?
Through the chair, may I try?
Yes.
I think the question really is not so much what fits the rest of the world, but what fits Alaska. And what does Alaska's prospects look like, and how do you manage the resources of Alaska for the benefit?
Right.
I mean, we are where we are in terms of the North Slope development. And when I was commissioner, the costs of getting the oil and gas out of the ground were immaterial relative to the value of the oil and gas, and a gross tax made sense. The reason we put an ELF in was to take advantage of while it was a very small percentage, to have a very high rate on that oil and gas. But over time, what's really available in an economic sense is the margin, you know, after you've got the cost taken out of getting it out of the ground. That's really what's available. You can still say, well, we'll tax on the gross, but if you do, it threatens to end up leaving oil and gas production in the ground. And you can look at the 1977 study that I co-authored. It's too long to read, a couple hundred pages, so you probably won't really get a chance to. But it talks, well, I hope not, but it talks about this issue, about a gross tax and its effect on investment and its effect ultimately on production when you push a field across the break-even point prematurely. And the ELF was the response of the Department of Revenue then. It's very clear. I mean, I'm not making this up now with 25 years of hindsight or 30 years.
Right.
Heavens. But that system was how we designed it then. Obviously, since then, there were problems that crept in with the ELF. Now, which is a worse set of problems? One of the things that Myrna didn't mention is that when I was director of the Petroleum Revenue Division, I got to administer the separate accounting tax, where all these types of deductions entered into the situation. It was the super tax on the net. And we made it work. I mean, it can be done. And I'm not a rocket scientist. So, I mean, I think that there are rocket scientists now who are working for the state and advising the state and the administration. And so, I mean, I have every confidence that they can look and see how we made separate accounting work back then, look and see what the tools are the legislature gave them in the PPT, and make this one work too. And structurally, for the future, where costs are not immaterial, as we look at what are the opportunities, heavy oil, fields in decline, Those are challenges, and this is a better suited structure for that type of future than if you were talking about a brand new province where you just discovered Prudhoe Bay.
Okay, last question, Mr. Chairman. Do you believe the bill, the statute that exists on the book, without the changes that Senator Wagner has proposed, that gives the standard for fraud and gross negligence, covers the hypothetical situation, the alleged situation, of no maintenance or improper maintenance that has been described? Do you believe that that is covered right now under the statute as it exists without adding more? If that were the case, and I know you're not here or the expert to say it was, pretend you're not BP. Pretend you're ConocoPhillips. Pretend you're Willikowski.
Don't pretend. We're not going to believe
Willikowski that. Willikowski Oil. And you're Willikowski Oil. And hypothetically, you had not maintained or improperly maintained a line. Do you believe that would fall under existing law?
Through the chair, I don't know enough about the actual facts of this circumstance to form an opinion.
Okay.
All I can say is that there seems to be nothing right now that would say it was gross negligence, because we've in fact said that we think that we're entitled under the existing law to take a deduction. So if you're asking about the actual facts, right now that would be the reading of it. But I don't know, I'm not in a position to really opine definitively. It's just simply right now, in terms of what we've seen, it does not seem to rise to one of those levels of willful neglect or willful misconduct, I'm sorry.
Okay, thank you. I want you to think about this, and then we'll get a question for Senator Wagner, and we'll come back to the question. The question is ex post facto law, and whether or not this provision that we're looking at, Senate Bill 80, which has a retroactive date to April 2006, will you speak to that in relationship to Alaska's laws, Constitution, and federal, but we'll come back to it. Senator Wagner.
First, it's not a question, it's a statement. Seems to me like we're letting ourselves being drugged back into a debate on PPT and not just this amendment. And I'd just like to remind everybody, PPT was, to boil it down to the lowest concept, was credits for exploration and new production, basically.
Right.
And we never intended through PPT, there was never discussion on the PPT legislation. And I sat through most of it, and I know Senator Stedman did. You sat through a lot of it. Never anything discussed or brought to the committee about a maintenance item of this size and of this expense. And just add one other thing. We've all got a letter from Don Bullock addressing your question, and I've already read that.
Yeah, so. I understand. Obviously, we need to touch on that. Senator Stedman, go ahead.
Well, at some point, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to talk about the Pedro Van Meer's involvement in his consultation with the administration and the legislature in dealing with this aging field and the potential costs of up to $2 billion in infrastructure improvements and the effect that the PPT would have on that as far as potentially putting the state at a disadvantage if PPT wasn't modified to disallow the 30 cents.
Yeah, I understand. We're going to hold that for another day, and that's exactly why I said there's a prelude. But we'll come back to that ex post facto.
Well, Mr. Chairman, as you're already aware, ex post facto laws are prohibited under the federal constitution as well as by the state constitution. What is an ex post facto law? You heard a dictionary definition of it last week. It's a law that changes the legal effect of an action or an omission, something that happened in the past, Or sometimes with respect in a criminal context, like a criminal penalty, it means you change the sentence or the fine that someone is exposed to after the act has already been committed. It can be a civil or criminal type situation, but it's changing the legal consequences of an action after the fact. Usually it means you have a specific fact in mind, mm-hmm. or a specific act or omission, or a specific person.
Which makes it worse.
And the closer it is, the closer the foundation is for an ex post facto law to be found.
That's right.
There is a related question of due process when you make an act retroactive. Ordinarily, it's a general law and you make it retroactive to the same calendar year but an earlier date, that doesn't offend due process. And if it's a general law, like the PPT itself was made retroactive to April 1st last year, it's a general law. It didn't have any specific thing or person or event or anything else in mind. It was a general law, and it was made retroactive. And that's when due process principles would apply. And those probably were not offended. It would be a long shot to try to take that case and say it was violated due process to make it retroactive to April 1st. It does become a little longer shot once you move into a different year. So the more retroactive you go, the farther back in time with legislation, the higher the risk can become about having a due process issue. So you have both the dimension of retroactivity as a due process issue, and then you have the issue in an ex post facto law about specificity of who or what it is that you're really intending to change the rule on.
Let me ask you in Meadow Lakes English, where I live.
I'm sorry?
Ex post facto.
Yes, sir.
Is it a violation, yes or no, in respect to Senate Bill 80? Yes or no? Your legal opinion.
I think there's a serious risk that it is an ex post facto law.
Okay, hold that. Mr. Robert Mintz.
Mr. Mintz, are you there?
He's my constituent,
yes, I am,
too.
Jeremy, can you hear me?
Yes. Mr. Mintz, ex post facto law, you heard the discussion we're having?
Most of it, yes. Thank
you. Would you put yourself on the record and give us your opinion about Senate Bill 80 and as it applies to ex post facto?
First of all, I should introduce myself. I'm lawyer with K&L Gates, working with the Department of Law, Department of Revenue on production tax matters. I think, generally speaking, that the prohibition against ex post facto law is limited to criminal penalty.
I'm sorry. Can we get an adjustment there on your mic? Maybe move a little closer or reposition
right,
a bit?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, that's better.
What I was trying to say was that my understanding of the constitutional prohibition on ex post facto laws is that that's generally been limited to a prohibition on retroactively changing or adding criminal penalties, and doesn't really generally apply to civil law. And I agree with Mr. Williams that when we come to the civil law context, it's really more a due process issue. And, of course, there's no absolute prohibition on retroactive changes in the law. And in the tax context in particular, generally speaking, retroactive changes in tax laws have been upheld. The courts have said that as long as you don't go too far in the past, that there's not a due process problem. We don't know exactly what the limit is. It is true that typically, when tax laws have been changed retroactively, the changes have been made to go back, for example, to the beginning of that same calendar year. We don't know that that's as far as you can go. Certainly, the farther you go, probably the larger the risk is of running into a problem. I would think that it's more likely than not that a change such as that proposed in SB 80, if it were enacted in the near future, and going back to April 1st, 2006, I would think that more likely than not that would be upheld. Now, Mr. Williams, I think, was also kind of focusing on a slightly different issue, but which might also have due process ramifications, and that is, when the legislature would make such a change, are you really focusing on a particular event, a particular individual entity? And, you know, that could be somewhat problematical. I wouldn't view it that way, personally. What I think it was Senator Stedman a few minutes ago that explained that when the legislature was looking at issues such as gross negligence, what costs would be deductible under the new law, it hadn't necessarily focused on the question of a major cost event that might be due to some sort of failure to observe industry practices. And so I think that the legislature should be cautious about making changes in the law, particularly retroactive changes that are targeted at, you know, a particular entity or particular event. But I wouldn't view it that way here. To me, it seems that basically the legislature has become more educated about some of the issues and some of the factual situations that might arise under the law, and that there may be a gap in the way that the current law deals with some situations, and where there may be policy questions that were not clearly before the legislature's that the legislature hadn't focused on when it was originally considering the legislation. And from that standpoint, I think it's perfectly legitimate to become informed based on more recent events, and for the legislature to consider what the appropriate policy is based on additional information.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Mintz. Senator Wagner.
2 out of 3, Mr. Chairman.
Right.
I'd just like to read into the record the memorandum dated February 26, 2007, to myself from Don Bullock, Legislative Counsel. And I just want to read a very short statement. You asked whether enactment of Senate Bill 80 would violate the prohibition against ex post facto laws in the United States and Alaska constitutions because of the disallowance of certain deductions applied retroactively. He said retrospectively, same thing, to April 1st, 2006, the effective date of the PPT. And then he said the answer is no.
Yeah, I just handed that memo around.
Thank
you. I just
you.
Got a copy. Yeah. Yeah, good.
Mr. Chairman, can I add one more thing
yes,
in the
ma'am.
Record, too, in the event this goes to trial someday? I kind of think it might. We're discussing the specific case of BP only because it's what's been in the news and described or alleged. But what the committee is generally discussing is what we would do with any company that failed to maintain properly or at all any line. So to be clear, I don't regard this bill as a specific response to a specific situation, but rather a recognition that an allegation, if true, could occur in the future, might have occurred, and we should address it.
Okay.
So I want to make that clear.
Yeah, thank you. I do not want to allow the people of Alaska be exploited. My take is much different than yours, and I got to say that in all candor. I mean, I think this is event driven. What my good friend Merle there were talking about it today about BP, you know, taking the citizens of Alaska based on the event that happened. So I mean, I just have to say that in all candor. I mean, that's my take on it. It's different, and that's just the way it is. So for
it certainly piqued people's curiosity and got the conversation going.
So
but
that's my integrity piece on it. That I have a different feeling on it. But in any event, thank you very much. We will revisit this. Adjourned.